Welcome to the Admin Admin Podcast, the podcast for people working in the real world of IT. If you're a sysadmin working on a help desk, a network engineer, an IT consultant, a computer techie who wants to know more about servers, or even if you want to get a job in the IT field, this podcast is for you. Hi, I'm Al.
And I'm Andy.
And I'm Jerry.
And 100100. Sorry, I wanted to do this podcast in binary, but the others wouldn't let me. So it sounds like they've been pretty busy this week. So what have you two been up to?
Yeah, talking about binary, but I'm going to have to get people to watch that computer file and number file thing on YouTube. It's really interesting. Thanks for getting me interested in that, Jerry.
It's really good, isn't it?
I subscribed to it. I was watching loads of stuff on there. It's really interesting stuff. So check those YouTube channels. Yeah, today I've had this issue. I had some bit of spyware to remove, and it all installed when someone installed uTorrent. Installed loads of adware kind of thing. And even if you removed this uTorrent thing and this bud doc ad thing, it was still every time in Chrome, whenever you tried doing anything, like just put ads up in, like inserts ads into your website, what you were looking at and stuff. And if you ever click on it, there's roll around ads in, click on it. But I ran all the spyware tools like malware and JR, malware bytes and JRT and all the normal ones. They removed everything, but again, Google Chrome wouldn't remove itself. Wouldn't remove it from Google Chrome every time you went. So I had to basically delete Chrome and then reinstall it again, and it was all fine. So
lucky it wasn't kind of in the registry or something like that, and it would have just popped up again.
No, it was like hidden inside Chrome somewhere kind of thing, so I don't know what was causing it. So
you can get quite a few hidden add-ons, and sometimes you've got the extension folder up there.
Yeah, I went into extension.
You can also delete that. Yeah,
there's nothing in there. Then someone said, "I'll go into the extensions folder inside the app data folder and delete it."
Yeah.
And did that? No. So I had to delete the whole folder in the end, and then that managed to delete it. So so that's only been installed. But all they did was install uTorrent, and that was it. So that's my interesting fact today. I've had a couple of issues this week with a couple of other things. My monitoring solution worked at one of our customer's site. One of the solutions said that one of the hard drives were getting low on disks. But this, like, see, had a C drive with two 300 gig mirrored drives, but somehow it managed to there's a file on there, 176 gig. It was called trace.txt on the C drive, and it was just keep growing and growing and growing, and it actually started created in, when was it, December 2013. So this file had been created, it just gradually got bigger and bigger and bigger until it got nearly filled the whole hard drive up.
How big was it again?
176 gig.
And that was a text file.
Yeah.
I remember when hard drives were 176 gig in their entirety.
So my monitoring solution worked, and it alerted the help desk that this was going to fill up. And it is basically, I googled trace.txt, and it was basically, I'll talk about this as well, is this VSS thing. Where it basically, when you snapshot things, you can it's basically the thing inside Windows, or basically Microsoft Volume Shadow Copy service. So basically, when you do snapshots or backups, it freezes the system, and then it makes sure anything changes between the backup starts and finishes, rolls it back in. And sometimes you get issues with that, with like semantic backup check or something causing issues. And to debug it, you can enable this virtual shadow copy debug tracing. It's basically a registry key you add in, and every time you run a backup or something happens in the background, it writes it to this text file. And someone had enabled this like 2.5 years ago, but forgot to stop it. So, but luckily we managed to delete the file and didn't manage to crash the whole system because it was a virtual server. It was a virtual host server, so it hosted about 10 virtual machines on it. So luckily didn't kill it. But yeah, if anyone finds a trace.txt file on their C drive, that's what it is.
The problem with things like that is you can't open it up in a text editor, can you, find out what it might be?
No.
Because that also kills your computer.
So. Yeah. So what other people been up to then?
Well, I've been having a bit of a nightmare with Plesk.
Right.
Now, Plesk is a, for those listeners out there that may not know, it's a web control panel for servers. It runs on Windows and Linux, but in this case it was on a Linux server, obviously, because that's my speciality. And I had the task of installing OwnCloud, which is a bit of software that lets you do things like sort of file sharing, other bits and bobs. And to do that, I had to put a higher version of PHP that was on the server. So I kind of did that, or tried to do that, and it just basically killed everything. It wouldn't serve web pages anymore. Now what it was, it upgraded Apache somehow, which is the web server, and the version that it upgraded to, all the config was incompatible. So basically, the web server died. So that was fun. The way I sorted that out was by going back to the previous version, but I had to kind of hunt around for config files and things. And the other thing was, in my efforts to fix it, I also managed to kill the mail. Now, I didn't kill the mail server. What happened was I moved some files, and the mail server couldn't find things where it was expecting to. So this poor guy, his website went down, and then his emails went down. Good news is I managed to get things working, kind of. The website works, the mail server works, but Plesk itself doesn't work at the moment. It seems to be stuck on it can't install itself for some reason, something to do with the installer, I reckon. So I think I'm going to be in the annoying position of having to call the Plesk support people and try and get it fixed. Because so that's a bit of liveliness for this week.
So you had to uninstall Apache or put an earlier version on then?
Because the way I installed this version of PHP, it kind of dragged the higher version of Apache in there.
Right. Okay.
One of the interesting things about the Plesk control panel is it runs on a completely separate web server based on Nginx. So you get a web control panel, but it doesn't affect your website, so you might be hosting with Plesk. I must say, up until this point, I found Plesk actually quite good, quite easy to use, and if something's gone wrong with it, it's quite easy to fix, but sort of behind the scenes on the command line where I usually am. But in this case, it just completely killed everything, and probably my actions in trying to fix it didn't do it much good. But you live and learn. There you go. I'm still haven't quite fixed it, as I said, but I'll get there in the end. So yeah, bit of excitement for this week.
What have you been up to, Andy?
Okay, well, a few things going on this week. One of them is the two different people have, and I don't get their sense in this, but they went to PC World to buy a laptop, and I said, yeah, no problem going to PC World to get a laptop. I said, but you know that they're going to try and sell you an antivirus. I said, you've already got an antivirus subscription, so don't get it, right? So they know that they're going to try and sell you Office, but you also already have an Office license and everything, so you don't need Office. So besides, you don't really need Office, really. I mean, they could get away with OpenOffice, so you don't need that. I said, and they're going to try and sell you, what's the thing they call, know-how, is it they call it, at PC World, which is like an extended warranty, blah, 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 something or other.
Yeah, so people can phone up if you've got a problem or whatever, or etc.
Yeah, so I told them about all of this. So they went off, left them to it, and about a day or so later they phoned me up, said, oh, we've got the laptop, can you come round and set everything up and blah blah blah, doing all the stuff. So I said, yeah, no problem. So we got round there, and they said, oh, they said, we know that you said that you didn't, that we didn't need all this stuff, but it all came in a bundle, so we got it all anyway. And
did they charge him for it as well?
Well, it's all part of the bundle, so obviously they did. And when I explained to them, oh, they were furious about one thing. They said, well, what's this? They didn't know, right? They said, what's this? They couldn't pronounce it. McAfee. I said, well, that is an antivirus product. He said, well, haven't we already got that? I said, yeah, you've got an active Norton subscription, which has got 2 years left on it. And you just bought, and, you know, they've just sold you this. He said, and he was like, well, I'm not going to use the words that they use, because we've been complimented that this is a family show and we've kept it clean. So he was a bit furious about that. So that was number one. And the other thing that they'd sold them, I mean, good as the product is, right, they'd sold them Norton 360. 365, sorry. No, hang on. I'm getting my 365 and 365. Office
365.
Office 365 that sold them. And they said, well, they said, yeah, well, it all came part of the bundle. I said, well, okay, that's fair enough. I said, we didn't need to have it. I said, you know, after in a year's time, you have to pay again the subscription. And he said, subscription? What subscription? I said, well, hence the name, 365. It lasts for 365 days. And then he kind of twigged, and then he realized that after a year, they've got to pay again for it. I mean, I'm not putting the product down anyway whatsoever, but they didn't even know that you had to pay for it yearly. And the bloke at PC World said, oh, the bloke at PC World said that Office 2010 won't work on Windows 8, so that's why they needed Office 365. They did not tell him it was a yearly subscription. They did not tell him what McAfee was. And they also got the know-how warranty and whatever all that lot does. Oh, it's an online backup, that's what it is. It's an online backup service that they have. And considering the fact that they've got two portable hard drives that they back up onto, I said, well, really, for what you need, you don't need that either, because that's a subscription service as well. So after telling them not to do any of these things because they don't need it, they went ahead and did it all. So I can't get the mentality sometimes of people. Even though you tell them to do things or not do things, they do the complete opposite. And there's another guy as well who's took the computer into PC World to get fixed. He's got it back home again, and then they haven't fixed it. And I'm going to see him tomorrow. So I'm curious to see what they've fixed and what they haven't fixed.
These people have got some kind of legal recourse, haven't they? Could they have been missold things?
He was going back. That one guy said he's going back. He said, I'm going back, he said, because I don't want this. I never asked for this. You know, and it's completely... So he's really furious about it, so he's going to go back. But there you go.
Thing is, it's nothing to them, is it? I mean, a sale's a sale.
Yeah,
and if he takes it back, then they'd just be down a sale. Whereas, it's the kind of thing that needs to be out there a bit more, I think. You know, obviously people like you advising
it's just knowing all this stuff, isn't it? Yeah, I mean they tell them that they've got a few things in a spreadsheet and a few things in that, and straight away they tell them. All they tell them is what they sell. That is, and I know that's their prerogative, I suppose, and it's not illegal to do that. All they tell them is what they sell. They're not going to turn around and say, look, if you're only going to do a few documents here and there, all you need is Open Office or LibreOffice or whatever. They're not going to tell them that, aren't they?
Even Outlook. Even Outlook.
Google Docs.
Or you can do Microsoft, or you can do, if you've got an Outlook.com address or a Hotmail.com address, you get the, you can use the online Word and stuff. So
that's it. Yeah, exactly. So I thought I'd vent about that because that's pretty frustrating. That leads on to another thing about telling people that they need to back up and they don't. But we'll get to that later. Another thing I've been doing this week is I've been learning about command line programming, if you like, and making batch files. Nothing for anything in particular, but I just thought it might be useful or interesting to learn a bit more how to make a batch file, how to do a little program, how to make variables. And I'll tell you, it's very similar because I started on the old Amstrad and using an Amstrad Basic. I find it very similar to that. Uses different wordings and things like that, but I think it's very similar. You know, variables.
It reminds me of reminds me of a line from Star Wars. You've taken your first step into a larger world.
That's it. Well, it's like going back in time for me because, of course, with an Amstrad, all you could do was program the damn thing. You know, unless you put your tape in and press play. You know, but everything I used to do on the Amstrad was, you know, line 10 this, line 20 this, line this, type it in, you know, typing in programs from the Amstrad magazine that never worked. You know, so I've been getting back into that again because I actually thought, I don't know where I heard somebody say, I don't know if it was Door-to-Door Geek, I don't know if it was him who said that every time he did something that he was going to do it again, he made a batch file for it. So he didn't have to do it again. You know, if you're doing something repetitive all the time, then why do it every single time? Make a batch file.
Sounds like a good idea.
Yeah, that was something he said a while ago. It just sort of stuck with me.
Have you ever come across I used this thing quite a few years ago now called Auto-IT.
No?
Where you could basically do things like key presses. You could automate key presses. I think you could do mouse clicks and things like that. And you can make an EXE out of it.
Yeah, so I used to do things like that on Excel, you know, you could make a macro. Macro button, you know, record something. Yeah. Click, click,
but
click,
I was using
type,
it for... I looked into it briefly to do, you know, installing things. I think it used to be Real Player. I guess it's going back a bit.
Yeah.
But it used to have to click through a million things and, you know, make sure you didn't install the extras and things like that. And you could just run this EXE and it would just launch it and click in all the right places and it'd be done. I suppose you've got things like Ninite now for installing utilities and stuff. But
that's another thing I've been trying to learn a little bit about again, and so I've been getting a bit interested in that. Another thing I've started doing again, which may surprise some people, is I've started listening to podcasts again. for quite a while, I haven't listened to that many. Mainly because I had this system set up in my old car where I could put podcasts onto a pen drive and everything. And now in this car, I didn't have anything set up and I kind of left it for a while. But now I've got a little FM transmitter for the phone, so I can just got some podcast software on the phone. And then plug that in and so it plays over the car radio. So I've been listening to a load more podcasts again. I heard Alistair on Call That Girl podcast. And I know he did that a while ago, but I've only just listened to it. And also he was on the Geeksters as well. Well, he wasn't personally, but his email was. So I heard him on that as well, so I've been catching up with the...
I need to do a voicemail for that, because he couldn't say what my critic was, what the router was, so I need to go in there and tell him what it had to say it.
That's right, yeah, he couldn't pronounce the... Or he didn't know how to pronounce the router name, did he?
So...
Okay. Well, that's what I've been doing this week. Oh yeah, there was one more thing, wasn't there, which was an interest in figuring out how to do a Pixie boot to load an ISO file, and you've got some info on that, haven't you? Or have you looked into
it? Yeah, well, I need to do a bit more research because I'm quite interested in doing it, but I listened to another one of their the podcasts, like, or they have like the call-in show on the Podnuts Network on a Sunday, and then someone said they use a program called Fog to do it. So it's like a thing you can do your menus and do your. So I want to have a look at that. So it might be a future show program project, yep. Or future show. And then because when Martin was saying on the Geek, because I couldn't really work out how you get to. I want to know how you choose the ISOs, really. There must be some sort of bit of software you can get that basically when it boots up into some little application, and then you can choose what ISO you want to boot up to. But people were using it, like, yeah. Martin was using it to basically boot up as all those ISOs. So if you wanted to boot up to check the memory, or you wanted to boot up CloneZilla or something to clone something, then all sounds quite interesting. But I mean, for you, Andy, you could have like a little at home, you could have like a little Raspberry Pi doing that, and yeah. Then maybe have a NAS box with your images on. So yeah, it's interesting. That I think we have to do a bit more research on that, and then have it as a future.
Yeah, definitely.
Show.
Yeah, I mean, you'd have ISOs where you could have Memtest on an ISO, Windows 7 on an ISO, Windows 8 on an ISO,
Linux on an ISO.
Yeah, Linux on an ISO. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And you can just BIOS, Pixie boot, hit. You know, and that's the bit that confused me as well. Or where to go is when you Pixie boot to the server. What does the server do? Then does it like a menu option?
Yeah, I think so. You know? Depending what it is, really. Because in Windows, it basically loads up like a little mini version of Windows.
Yeah.
Can't think what the term is. What you call it? If you're using, well, I talked about before about where you can use either SCCM or the imaging inside 2012 to image it. So, yeah, we can go into that further. I was going to say, if you know, do you guys use Google Chrome a lot or not? Because I kind of live in Google Chrome.
Yeah, using it right now.
I'm a Firefox user still. Today I'm a bit wary of Google with their, you know, collecting all my data.
Oh, well, that's another thing.
I'm not that paranoid, but you know, it's good to. Anyway, sorry. Go ahead.
And you need to watch Citizen 4.
Oh yeah, I've seen that. Yeah,
I watched it this week.
I actually acquired it, but it was on Channel 4, wasn't it?
Yes.
I managed to acquire it from somewhere. I'm not saying where.
Yeah. I watched it on 4 catch up, and it's really good. So
yeah.
Well, I've missed the last 10 minutes. I haven't watched the last 10 minutes yet, but I fell asleep. Okay. It was like 11:30, 12 o'clock when I was watching it. Kind of thing.
It wasn't that bad, was it?
No. It was just... it's really... It kind of makes you really think about what they're doing. But I can't imagine...
It won an Oscar, didn't it?
Yes. What I want to know is how they managed to get the data from the optical fibre. Because apparently the UK is the one who's... He's gathering this all this information up, isn't it? The most, isn't it? Apparently.
Apparently, that's why it's called Prism. It is something to do with the light coming through the fibre.
Right.
It's just basically siphoned off, and they just collect all the data.
But where do they store it? Think how much data we get at work today.
They've got these data centres. There's pictures of them. You know, and they're just built in the American desert somewhere, and. There's, you know, they've got whatever it is, exabytes of data there, and it's all just as well. From what I gather, it they collect it all, and it's just sitting there, and then they can process it whenever they want. You know.
Yeah.
I know I'm sounding like a tinfoil hat brigade here, but apparently it's been proven. So.
Yeah. Scary stuff, but hey, the yeah.
So you know, just make sure you encrypt people. it's probably at a minimum you should encrypt,
yeah.
and then worry about the other stuff later.
Yeah. So going back to my Google Chrome thing is that, you know, if you ever have Google Chrome and you go offline or something, or you're on your Android phone or whatever, and it goes, a little dinosaur comes up.
Oh yes, yeah.
That's a game you can play. If you press the space bar, he starts running, and he just has to press a space bar to jump over things.
Oh my god!
An Easter egg.
Don't try it now, cause but
I can't go offline now. The show will be ruined.
Yeah, but next time that little dinosaur comes along, you can press the space bar and you can start jumping along.
Yeah, good to know.
Yeah. Also, last week we were talking about the virtual or the CPU cores or whatever. And about how many virtual CPUs you can get, and I was saying that it's more than memory, but I kind of worked that a bit more, because VPCPUs is, they reckon that the maximum you can have in vSphere 5.5 or 5.1, sorry, what I said, is 24. So every core you can have, so if you've got a process with 8 cores in it, you can, each of those cores can run 25 vCPUs is the maximum you can run. So when you start getting the issues, if you start having more virtual CPUs than you have actual, how many whatever cores there are, and it's all to do with the ready time, or the CPU ready time, and the VMware can't keep up with saying yes, I'm ready to do something, that's when things start slowing down. As long as you have enough cores in your machine and you don't go over 25 vCPUs per core, then you should be okay. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's really quite a lot, isn't it, per virtual CPU. I mean, I've got this, this is not VMware, but I've got this machine at work, I think it's dual core, and we've got about seven or eight VMs on there now, and it seems to be suffering a bit, but I wouldn't be surprised if that's just, you know, it's doing computation, so
it's causing the ready time. Well, I guess it's probably it's not enough ready time for it to work. So the other thing I've been doing this weekend is this doing 4.1 upgrade to VMware 4.1 to 5.5.1 upgrade, but we actually get a 5.5 upgrade this time, because some of the hardware that customers got can't support 5.5, so their hardware can be upgraded to 5.1. That's the actual OS which goes on the server. But we use this thing called Virtual Center, we had me talk before. That can go up to 5.5, and 5.5 can control 4.1 and 5.1 servers. But with VMware 5.1, there's this thing brought up called vCenter Single Sign-On, which is basically a component of the VMware Cloud Infrastructure Suite. And it basically deals with the management of identity. In VMware before 5.1, all the management of like adding users in or adding in domains, so you can do domain authentication, was done inside the VMware in the actual vSphere. But after 5.1, it actually goes into a single sign-on database in 5.1, and it basically means that you have that installed, and then all the other products like vCloud Director, all the other VMware products, all can go into this single sign-on. So you sign in once, and then you can then basically have it look at it, you can then authenticate on all the other devices. And it's actually 5.1 is actually using a bit of RSA software, using a SQL database, but with 5.5 they completely rewrite it. So we're going to go straight from 4.1 to 5.5, and it's just like a simple import. So basically, you basically install this little software single sign before you actually install, or you do the upgrade for vSphere 5.5, and it basically you have to give it a master password, like a root password, and you have to keep that safe. And once you've done that, you can then go in there and add the LDAP or your Active Directory domain in there to do all the authentication. But that's quite interesting. I'll put a link in the show notes about
that. That's for VMware itself, not the virtual machines that it's controlling.
Yes, basically vCenter controls all the ESXi hosts. So if it has a failure, or it migrates between physical hosts, that's what does all that.
But can you you can back that with Active Directory? That authentication. Yeah.
Yes. Okay. It's basically your role based. So you set the roles up in VMware vCenter. vCenter server, but then you do all the permissions and everything in single sign-on.
So I mean, the other
Go on.
So I was just going to say, it is a strange mix between making things easy for the, you know, for the user, but it's still complex things underneath, which it is. I mean, it's a very complex, virtualization is very complex, or computationally anyway. And it's interesting.
So VMware 6 is imminent to come out, kind of thing. So we're looking at the main feature of VMware thing is called a thing called vVol, which is a kind of a basically a different way of looking at how you store your virtual machines. In before VMware 5.5 or VMware 6, you get a thing called data stores. So you would create like your LUN, and then you'd then pretend that LUN to your VMware, and then you'd have to format that in VMware, and that's then called a data store. And a data store is like you normally like create like a 5 terabyte or 1 terabyte, and then you put your virtual machines inside that data store. So it's like basically it's like a virtual, the thing is like a virtual hard drive, which then you put other virtual hard drives in it, so that it's just basically where all your little virtual hard drives go. But the problem with that is that it's not very granular, and it's like you're basically taking your storage away from your storage manufacturer, away from your VMware environment. So what you're going to do with vVol is only at the moment is supported with FreePAR. You might have heard me talk about it, but it's basically HP flagship storage solution. It's like what they're going towards. It's a yellow box. I'll put a link in the show notes, but it's just where it does all this thing with chunklets and everything. It's very clever. And what VMware 6 is going to do, you're basically going to basically not have data store. You're basically going to basically tell VMware talk directly to the storage using this thing called VASSA, which is basically vStorage API for storage awareness. And basically you tell it where the storage is, and you say, right, I want to give this amount of storage to my VMware environment. And then you can then, when you create a virtual machine, it basically creates the virtual machine's virtual hard drives directly on the storage. And so it's really clever. So you haven't got, yeah, it's just really clever. And then you can just create them as you go along, so you're not wasting your space like you've done before. But you can also do things like granular things. So say if you wanted to replicate that VM off to another FreePAR, you can say, right, I want to copy that vVol to my other FreePAR. Or you want to do a snapshot, you can then say, right, just do that virtual machine or vVol. But when you're having things like data stores, but we said before, and LUNs, you have to, when you do a snapshot, you're basically freezing the whole data store, which obviously freezes all the virtual machines for whatever microsecond it's doing it for. Or if you're doing replication, you are replicating the whole data store, so you're replicating all the little VMs inside it, whereas doing it this way, you can replicate your little vVols, and you can do your snapshot. So I'll put a link in the show notes about that. Basically about a FreePAR dude, he's quite good. He just blogs about FreePAR stuff, and he's got. And I'll put a link to an HP video, what shows you how to configure it. So that's an interesting little thing to come.
So it exposes the storage to the VMware environment, so
directly.
You can sort of control it. So that's quite handy, I imagine.
Yes. So, because before, like it's saying, like, the storage guy would have to create the LUN, then the VMware guy would have to request the LUN to be created, etc. It's taking a long time. But where if you just say, right, here you go, go away, kind of thing. So, yeah, it's good. So, how far have we got on the show today? It seems like we've been talking for ages, really.
I think about half an hour now, 35 minutes.
Yeah, cool. 35 minutes.
Cool. So what do we want to talk about? Backups, weren't we going to talk about? So do you want to talk
about backups? This is our backup plan.
Did you want to talk about Linux first there, Jerry?
I can do. Yeah, okay.
Although my throat's a bit hurting and my nose is giving me jit. I don't want to...
you've got a cold, haven't you?
Yeah.
I actually had a flu jab this year. apparently, because I've got asthma, I'm entitled to it. But no one ever told me.
Did you go and get it? Or?
Yeah. I'm always up for an inoculation. especially if it's free.
What type of backups are we going to talk? Well, because I thought there's kind of my way of backups is that if you're going to back up Windows kind of stuff, you can either do the file level backup and system state backups is my traditional way of thinking of doing stuff. But I'll let you talk about your stuff first, Jerry.
Okay, well, there's a few... I think with backups in general, there's a few approaches, and they're generally, platform agnostic. Basically, you're getting data from, where it is and to somewhere else, either off that machine, on that machine, on another machine, off-site. And that's the main thing. You've got data you want to keep. You want to keep it safe. So, like with everything with Linux, there's many different ways of doing it. The way that I generally use is something called rsnapshot. Now, what rsnapshot is, it's based on rsync, which is basically a utility in Linux which copies data from one place to another, and it can do clever things like, if you've got data at the source and data at the destination, it will only copy the data that needs to be copied. It will say, oh, I've got all this data already, I only need these other bits of data that I haven't got. So that's the sort of power of rsync. Rsnapshot is a script written around rsync designed to do backups. So you give it a destination where it's got a backup to, you give it the sources that it's got a backup, and it will do incremental backups. Actually, we might go on later to talk about what incremental backups are, but it will copy when you first run it. It will copy all the data, and then the next time it runs, it will copy the data that's changed, and it will structure it in such a way that you can go back to backups from a long time ago. And so let's say your oldest backup will be from the original data set, and then say a file has changed last week, you can go back to last week's backup and you can get that changed version, or you can go back earlier, and it does all that by sort of clever linking and things. It uses a thing in Linux called hard links to basically link back to the oldest instance of that data. So yeah, it's pretty clever. So what that means is it takes up the only disk space you require is the original data set plus any changes. So it's quite efficient with space as well. So yeah, that's really good. And it's what I use for my freelance clients, and we've also used it in my day job as well. So yeah, there's that. There's rdiff backup. Now I haven't done my research on this. I don't use it. I haven't done my research on this, but I think it's pretty similar. It doesn't use rsync, but I'm just looking at how to about it now. Uses SSH. And presumably does the same kind of thing as our snapshot. So somewhere where I should have done a bit more research, but feel free to go off and research it for yourself. there's the other ones basically Dropbox. You can get Dropbox integration for Linux, and you can script that if you're that way inclined. CrashPlan is a commercial backup. It's available for Windows and Mac, and they also, bless them, they do a Linux client. But I've played around with the Windows version, and the kind of the power of the Linux version is that you can back up NFS shares, which is the equivalent of like a Samba share or a mapped drive in Windows. So you can back. I use it to back up my NAS, and that's got its own client. It does backups at given times and so on, and I use that for all my things like baby photos that I don't want to ever lose. So I know they're safe.
Are you paying for CrashPlan or not?
Yeah, I pay about it's $5 a month, I think. So works at about £3.50 or something. And there doesn't seem to be any limit on the data. I'm backing up terabytes to them, so and I have done some restores, so I know it all works.
I was going to say, I want to implement CrashPlan on my wife's computer, which is basically all our photos on it. At the moment, I'm basically using a built-in Time Machine to back up to hard drive, and I'm also doing an rsync thing using to back up to a NAS. But I want to basically get an off-site copy, and I think CrashPlan seems to be the best one for the Mac client. So yeah. For $3 a month, $5 a month, whatever, it seems to. I'm guessing it's getting that data up there. The big thing is getting it up there first. But does it have a version control thing as well, or
not that I know of.
Because I'm just worrying. Can you hear about these people talking about? One of the things I want to ask Martin Abando about, but he probably won't tell you. But I want to know, if you. Say you got your files got encrypted or whatever, and you don't what with the crypto locker or something on Windows, that if it then starts uploading your encrypted files to the web, it's a bit pointless, isn't it?
Because
I want us to start because going back to what I'm saying when I started in IT, the first thing I got drilled into me is backups, backups, backups. The first thing you do in a day when you come in the office is look at your backups. And I've always done a look at his backup, and it's been quite a big thing. But I've never really paid attention to other people's backups. If I ever set up a computer for someone, I've always kind of just left it to them to decide their own thing. And I'm thinking with hard drive failing these days and scary thing to keep getting crypto locked, I need to kind of come up with a solution so I can say to people, look, this is what I recommend. I was thinking about writing a blog post ad and say, look, just buy CrashPlan. But I want to test it out. But if you say you've been using it for a couple of months or a couple of years or whatever, then it can't be that bad kind of thing. So.
Yeah, well, I mean, if the Linux client's good, then I'm sure the Windows and Mac clients are good as well. The only thing is, you've got to remember, they don't do map drives. So if you're backing up I don't know about Mac, but if you're backing up a Windows PC, you can't back up a network drive on it.
Yeah.
But with Linux, you can.
Yes.
So, maybe
so all I want to do basically is to back up my photos, really, because I don't anything else I can really replace. It's just photos, isn't it? Really, music and stuff you can replace, and videos and stuff. But photos is the number one thing, isn't it? So.
Yeah. Well, another good thing about CrashPlan is you can set up CrashPlan on a remote computer, like your mate's computer or your mum dad's computer or whatever.
Yeah.
And then you can run CrashPlan at both ends, and you can back up to the other computer, so you don't have to back up to their data center.
Yeah.
You can back up to someone else's computer that you know.
Yeah.
Which is quite handy. You've just got to take a backup for that versioning thing, CryptoLocker thing. You've just got to take a backup and put that somewhere else, make a copy of the backup.
Yeah.
So if it ever gets overwritten or encrypted, then you've still got the original.
Yeah.
I think it's always more complicated than it seems, backups.
Yes.
So you've got to be a little bit clever. You probably make a lot of money writing a bit of software that gets it right.
Yeah.
You know. But I think people do need to realise that it does need doing, you know. Yeah. It's very important. If you, well, if you value your data, you've got to back it up.
Yeah. And that's the thing. People start going, oh, I need to make sure my data can come back this quickly or whatever, but they have to pay for it. Or no one ever really worries about backups until it fails or something, they lose something. And then it's...
Yeah.
So, on my Windows side of things, or virtualization, what I was going to talk about is get my... document up is you got your classic file backup. So what I think in Windows stuff is there's a is to get your machine back up and running as quickly as possible is that you need to do your file backup. I call my classic backup is what I think of is backup exec, your semantic backup, and a backup and a tape drive. So you set your job up and you say, well, apparently, annoyingly, in like 2013, backup exec 2013, it kind of changed the way it looks. But before that, in 2010 and before, you would say to your table, I back up this computer, and you basically back up the C. So you'll say you've got a CD drive, and you tick the box, and it'll back up the C drive, the D drive, and the system state. Let's say you didn't have Exchange or SQL database or anything. And what that'll do is that'll back up all your files on a C drive, all your files on a D drive, and using shadow copies, it would back up any open files kind of thing. So, like, all the... Because, like, you know, if you've got DHCP running on that server, it won't back up the database because it's in use, but VSS backs that up. And then you've got a thing called system state, which basically backs up your things like your registry, your computer account details. Like if it's on the domain, it will back up the SID and stuff for you. So what would happen is that if you ever lost your machine, let's say, you would basically install Windows again, install backup exec, and then you would to catalog your tape, and then you would tell it to restore your all your files and your system state. And you basically just say replace any files. You just say replace all the files, even if the files on the computer are newer, and that'll basically get your computer back to the state it was pre-disaster. And I have spent many a night restoring servers, and semantic backup exec has got me out of that sticky situation where like you've lost two hard drives in a RAID 5 set, and you lost everything. So there's also other extra bits you can do. So let's say you've got Active Directory or Exchange or SQL, it also you can buy agents what back up those bits, and you can back up Exchange and SQL and Active Directory. And I've managed to do a restore a whole server, and it back restored the whole Windows directory, the whole of the users files, the whole of Active Directory. And once you restore Active Directory, you can then restore Exchange, and then you can restore SQL databases. So that's quite good. And even you can do it because, like, let's say with the old days where you have the. So I was like backing up the tape still at some point. If it's a physical machine, I still want to back up the tape because I know that tape still works. And you can physically get your tape and you can take it off site, if you know what I mean, and you've got an off site copy. And you can do really easy retention periods with that. Because you've got a tape, haven't you? And you can just put that tape to the side, and you can say, right, that's my monthly backup, or whatever. Well, that's my yearly backup for 2014. With your backup exec, you can do the thing where you can have like agents, so you can have a backup exec server, and have an agent on each of the machines, the physical machines you're backing up, and it will back up that over the network. So if you lost one of those servers, all you'd have to do is restore the machine, put the backup agent on it, and then restore the files back to that server. So that's what I call your classic backup file in Windows, and Semantic has got me out of a couple of sticky situations. So
yeah, we use NetBackup at work, which I think is similar. It's Semantic now. It used to be a company called Veritas, so I think Backup yes. Exec did as well. Mm-hmm. I don't know what the difference between Backup Exec and NetBackup is, but they seem pretty similar.
And yeah, I can't remember what the difference is. It, it's using like cashless converters and stuff for it. So I can't think what it is, what the difference is, but
yeah.
But it, and that's,
I mean,
go on.
It's effectively scheduling that copying of data, and sorting out the tape bit. But you still have to do quite a lot of work on the tape side. You know, organizing your tapes and defining backup pools, and you know, and you could do other complicated things, like you can have other servers other than your computer being tape servers or media servers, as they call them. And you can do things like backing up to disk, or you know, staging it on disk and then writing it to tape, things like that, all sorts of clever stuff. But you can get very lost in backups.
But the good thing about backup at sec is that it does it all. You can use scheduling, because like basically in Windows 2003, NT backup and above, and then Windows 2000 I think as well, is basically Veritas backup, but a cut down version of it. So, and that's just, it's really hard to schedule, you have to run create a bat script, whereas like if you've got backup exec, it does everything for you, it does all your emails, it does an email alert for you, etc, etc. You get, again, you do the thing like you say, where you can do all your tape pulls and everything as well. So,
there was a thing with Windows Home Server where you connect, you know, you had all your, in this sort of example they gave, is you have all your Windows PCs and you've got your Windows Home Server, and you just, they contact each other, talk to each other, and then they back up. You can set a backup of just the whole computer, you can basically clone it. So I don't know, because I know Windows Home Server didn't make it, they got called something else, so I'm wondering if that technology carried on to later versions.
I'm just looking at comparison between backup exec and net backup. Net backup supports a lot more like Unix servers than what you do with the old backup exec. So
I guess that's why we're using it, because we use it for Linux.
Apparently you can do a lot of command line Windows stuff with it as well. So
looking at it's kind of in two different parts on Linux. There's a bit that deals with the tape and there's a bit that deals with the backups. They are actually two separate programs, but
it writes data in a tar format, apparently.
But it's not the same as the Unix tar, which is confusing. But yeah, that's how you write stuff to tape in Unix. Use the tar command.
Yeah, apparently you can do a lot. You can do a net backup master server, which basically manages multiple media servers all from one place. Going back to backups, with the backup to tapes and stuff, is that it's probably best worth talking about what full backups are, incremental backups, and differential backups are. What you've got is the different types of backups. So a lot of people in the old days, when you get the old DDS4 tapes and stuff, it took a long time to back up a server. So what you do, you do a full backup on a weekend, and then on a Monday all the way to the Friday you would do a differential backup. Now I can never remember which one is which.
So a differential incremental,
yes.
I think differential is how it's different from the day before, and incremental is how it's different from the full backup. So in my R snapshot example, I'm doing continuous incremental backups because it's seeing what was the day or the time before that it ran, and then backing up the differences.
I think it's the other way around.
Oh, okay.
In my notes, I've written differential backups were the next step in the evolution of backup strategy. A differential backup backs up only the files that changed since the last full backup. For example, you do a full backup on the Sunday, and on Monday you back up the files that have changed since Sunday. On Tuesday, you back up all the files that changed since Sunday, and so on and so on. Whereas incremental backup is that you back up only the changed data since the last backup. So you do a full backup on the Sunday, then on Monday, any files change. Normally it's on like a bit change in Windows, like a little archive bit, which says I've been changed, and you back it up. And then I think it doesn't like it. Yeah, I'll go back to a minute. And then it backs up the files, and then it packs it to tape. And then on the next day, it backs up only files what had changed since the day before. So that if you had to do a restore using differential, all you'd have to do is get your backup tape from month and Sunday. Let's say you had a backup fail on Thursday morning. You'd have to get your tape backup from the weekend and your tape from Wednesday. You basically do a full restore from the backup tape, and then you do a restore with the Wednesday tape. But if you were using incremental, you'd have to get your backup tape from the weekend, plus your Monday tape, plus your Tuesday tape, plus your Wednesday tape. So,
do you use backup robots at all on any of your sites?
Yes.
Yeah, they're quite cool, aren't they?
Yes.
So you don't have to feed the tapes in one by one. You basically put all the tapes in the library, and it picks out the ones it needs.
Bit like in Hackers at the start, when it goes along and takes the tape away.
Yeah, I've seen it in a lot of films. In fact, there's one, I can't remember what it was. I think it was True Lies or Mission Impossible or something like that. And there's a massive one. And where I work, there used to be one of those. So they took it out. I don't know why. They should have just left it there because it looked cool. But they took it out.
So the other type of thing is what I'm calling the Veeam backup, which is the way of backing up the actual physical, or not the physical, the virtual VHD file. So you're backing that up to using Veeam, to backing it up to like another storage, like load to disk. So when you do a restore, you haven't got to reinstall the operating system and reinstall the backup second disk. All you have to do is restore that file, and then you've got your server back up and running straight away, if you see what I mean. So that's why it's good. But again, you've got the problem where you have a thing where you, how long do you keep them for? Because normally we keep them for 14 days, and then your grandfather father son thing, which we haven't really talked about, like where you keep rotation for is where it gets interesting. So that's another way that, and I was going to talk about the way that that works, like the incremental thing inside it works in Veeam, but I'll just need to find a document what tells me it, because I've written a little cheat sheet about it, so I'm going to find that quickly. Have you got anything to say on backups, Andy, if you're still there?
Yeah, still here. I was going to say about it's all very well doing this and having all these plans and different methods of doing it, but the biggest problem I have is getting people to do it in the first place. You know, in a client.
I was going to say, actually, I think any good backup strategy, it needs to be automated, so it doesn't rely on people to actually do the backups.
Well, what I mean is for them to actually say, yes, we need to do a backup, let's get the equipment, let's get the stuff, let's get the plan in action. Because several of them that I know, just they say, yeah, let's do this, let's do that, but then they never pay for it. They never want to do it.
Yeah.
It's almost waiting. You know, as you're saying before, the biggest time that somebody wants to do an actual backup is when it all goes wrong.
I think you need, I've been listening to quite a lot of the this call-in show on the Podnuts network, and they say you need to tell that you need, I think the best way to describe it, if you told the user, if you lost that laptop tomorrow and you lost all that data on it, how long will your company be able to work for without that data? Because
you
like
turn it, you can turn it into how much money will you lose if you lose all your data. So if it's that worth that much, then spend that much money on a backup solution.
That's it. And when you tell them all this, then I'm thinking of one particular customer. When you tell them all this, then they're like, yeah, yeah, oh, I couldn't live without the computers because everything we do is on them. We couldn't live. If we lost that data, then we'd be completely screwed. Mm. And they say, okay, right, well, let's do it then. Right, give us some prices. Let's see, you know, what methods we can do. Let's get something going. And then they never do.
I think you just got to make it as easy to do and as automatic as possible, so they don't have to think about
yeah.
it.
Yeah, I was going to be automatic. Like, yeah.
Maybe something like a Raspberry Pi and a USB drive is the simplest thing and yeah. quite, you know, fairly cheap. So
that's it, and that's the biggest problem.
Somehow replicate that.
That's the biggest problem I have. I mean, a lot of people are like, "Yeah, let's, you know, make sure we have one." You know, make sure it's in place. A lot of people are, but some people just don't want to do it in the first place. It's like, it's preventative, isn't it? It's all preventative. Another thing I've talked about with people as well is contingency planning in general. You know, not just backup, not just what will happen if you lose your backup. What will you lose if you lose your data? You know, how will this is more of a business thing probably, but how will your company function if you lost the internet for the day? What would everybody do? You know, because several places they're just on the computer online all day every day, and if they had no internet, then they just can't work. You know, so what contingency plans can they have or do they have for lack of internet? You know, something that's completely outside of their hands. You know, they could be digging up the road outside for digging up a water main or something, and they accidentally cut through a telephone cable that goes to their office. You know, they could be out of they could have no internet for a week. What did he do? You know, I talk to people a lot about that, as you know, contingency planning in general with computers. If you don't have a computer, what can the staff do?
Just out of interest, what do they come up with?
Yeah. Well, it depends on the situation that they have. But one idea that I gave them, this one place is an estate agent, and one idea that I gave them, they only have 5 or 6 machines. You know, you can imagine estate agents on a high street, 5 or 6 machines in the actual office itself. And my advice was to get a 3G USB drive. And if they did lose internet to the whole place, then at least they could use a 3G dongle. Share it around. Right, you check your emails, plug it in, connect, check the emails, things like
you
that.
You can often do tethering with phones, can't you, now? So you could add, you know, 5 or 6 devices usually. So
yeah.
That acts as like a little
yeah.
router.
Yeah.
It's just whoever's phone you're using, you want to make sure that, you know, you keep track of how much data's used and so on.
You know, a lot of them are pay-as-you-go as well, aren't they? I know somebody uses one of those things. It's like a little mobile router which uses 3G or 4G. I think it's an EE.
Yeah. It's like a MiFi, isn't it, or something
that's
like
it.
That.
But yeah.
You can
yeah.
often do that just through a phone, depending on your contract. You can do that just through
right.
the phone itself. Yeah.
Well, I suggested to these one people, you know, they don't necessarily have to have a contract on it where they're paying £15 every month. Or whatever, just in case, you know, they could have it pay as you go. Because this is the kind of thing, it's only a contingency plan, it's only if things go wrong, you know, and all they have to do is put £20 credit on it, and then it works whenever whenever everything goes wrong, they can use it instantly. And if they run out of credit, they can buy some more. It's just something to keep them going for the time being.
A lot of the Fargo routes I've put out in the past, so you can put a USB modem on it, which then you can have 3G and stuff on it. So a lot of places now you can get 4G. I'm quite surprised how 4G has quickly came about in the UK. How
It is. It's quite widespread now. It's much more widespread than I thought. Of course, it's a lot slower, but it's just a temporary way of doing it, isn't it?
Yeah. Okay, I found my document. So, with the Veeam thing, when you take a first copy of your... If you do a full backup of a machine, it basically converts... It basically pulls the VHD file and puts it into a VBK file, which is a Veeam backup file, okay? And there's two ways you can set the backup. So, you can either do a reverse incremental backup or a forward incremental backup. So... The way I'll read it, so I'll go the reverse incremental backup first. Basically, what it is, a full BBK is created. All sequential backups are incremental. That is, Veeam backup replication copies only those beta blocks that have changed since the last job run. During the reverse incremental backup, Veeam backup injects changes into the VBK file to build its most recent state of the VM. It also creates reverse incremental backup files, VRB, containing the data changes that are replaced when the full backup is rebuilt. So what that means is that you take a backup of your VHD and you create a VBK file, and you've got that file, and you use a thing called CBT in VMware, and it's basically chain thought tracking, and it basically makes note of all the files, the things that have changed since the last backup. So when you do your next backup the next day, you don't basically take the VHD file again, you only take the changes, and what you do is you then put those changes into the VBK file, so that your VBK file is always the most recent version of your VM. So if you ever wanted to do a restore, all you do is you restore that one file, you don't have to restoring other files at the same time. But at the same time, any files what has changed in that night between the 2 days, it puts it into a little file and it basically puts it backwards. So it's like you got your VHD at the start, so you always got your forever full file, so you never ever have to take a full backup again. So if you've got a massive server, like I had one the other day, you had a 2 terabyte server which always took like 18 hours to back up to start with, you never have to do it again. You just back it up, you're only backing up the changes every day, so like for an hour a day it only takes an hour to back up. So then you'd keep, we normally keep 14 days, so we'd keep one VBK file and then 13 VRB files. Does that make sense?
Okay.
And then you've got the forward incremental backup, is where you basically, you do your full backup, and then during the first full run of the full incremental backup, or simple incremental backup, Veeam creates a full backup file. Any sequential backups is only given get changes that have been taken place since the last backup, where the full incremental, and then saves them as a little VIB file. So you keep them for 14 days. So normally after, what we do is that you, with that thing, we normally do a full backup every week, so that you'd have a full backup on one Sunday, and then the next Sunday you do another full backup. But in between those full backups, you have 5 or 6 little bibs for all the day changes, and then you keep enough of those for 14 days. So it's kind of like you're doing your backup to tape, and then doing your little files after that. So, and that's the way Veeam kind of does it. But we always kind of do the reverse incremental backup way, because you've always got a full backup of your VM, and you've got your little, and if you ever need to restore anything, normally if you want to restore something, it's going to be, you've got a down server and you need to restore the whole thing, where if you need to restore a file, it normally means you can go back easier than having to restore the whole VM. But I'll put that in the show notes, so with my little backup chain diagram. So yeah, I think we're going to be there for this week on the old backup. Any other questions or anything anyone else to bring to the table?
Oh, I just had a couple of things to add. One of the ones I missed with Linux solutions is called SyncThing, and what that allows you to do, it's I've heard it's like BitTorrent Sync, so I've heard. I haven't used BitTorrent Sync, but basically you define two directories on two different machines and it will keep those directories in sync across the network or the internet or whatever, and it works really well. Sync thing, they say it's harder to set up than BitTorrent Sync, but it's not that hard. And it's kind of under development, still open source and everything. It's available for Windows as well, so maybe something people might want to look into. And the last thing was, often with a server, especially a Linux server, you don't want to back up the whole server. There's no point in backing up the whole OS, because in Linux there's called the etc directory, which is where most of the configuration sits for anything that's running. So there's a little utility called etc keeper, which will take it will basically version control your etc directory, so that you can effectively take a snapshot of all your configuration. So say a server died and you've got the configuration backed up using this utility, you can just re-image the server and just put the etc directory back, and all your apps are configured how they were. So that's another approach, and it's a very small amount of data in etc.
What's it called? Etc what? Etc?
Etc keeper, or etc keeper is another way of saying it, I suppose.
Yeah, because that's the thing I'm worried about, that if you lost your whole VPS or whatever and then you restore it, then it's getting to, I'm guessing if you keep it up to the latest version, like if you're keeping your Yum update or your thing up to date, then all you need to do is reinstall the
but you want to restore your etc, which is where all the configuration for everything that runs on the server lives. And with it uses Git by default, which is great, because with Git you can basically offsite that quite easily.
Yeah.
So have all your configuration sitting somewhere else, and then just blat it back onto the server when you restore it.
Yeah.
So could make quite an effective.
I'll have to have a look at that etc keeper.
Yeah, it's worth installing. Because I think it does an update every night or every once a week or something like that. So if you make any changes, you'll generally be able to roll back, because it will have automatically made a copy of it. Getting it off-site is an exercise for the reader, as they say. I haven't done it yet. Or the listener, not the reader.
Okay.
So yeah, that was it from me.
I want to say that we wanted to show about help their software, because we had a request. And if anyone can email in of what currently the software they're currently using for the help desk, or any real life examples or stories or anything they want to share with us, that'd be really good, because I want to get the listeners involved with that, really. So email us what you use.
Plus it'll save me from spending the whole show moaning about my employer's in-house help desk software. So I could easily fill a show with that, I think.
But we've had an email, haven't we, Andy?
Yes, we have. And I'm going to attempt to pronounce his name, so apologies if I pronounce it completely wrong, but honestly I don't know how to pronounce it. But Moshe de Frugier is the best.
I would say Mosh de Freudiger.
Okay.
Could be either, or somewhere in between.
Okay, well, he wrote in and he said, "Hi, I really enjoy your podcast. I'm up to episode 8 so he's got a bit of way to catch up yet, hasn't he? Because where are we now? 18? Is this 18? Yeah. And he's catching up whenever he has a spare moment. Now to my question. Is there any way you can send me a link to buy your intro music, or at least the name of the artist and song? Thanks a lot." Well, that's an interesting question, don't you think? because you're listening to the artist who wrote that song. So, and the answer is, there is no way to buy it, but you can listen to it on YouTube, And also what we can do as well is we can play the whole song if you want after at the end of the podcast. So instead of just having the normal outro music, we'll play the whole song for you. Yeah, so the little band that I say it's a band, it's all me actually. I record using a drum backing track. I record my own bass line, guitar, keyboards if necessary, and vocals. The band, if you go and look it up on YouTube, is called The Clay Foxes. And you can get to it directly at youtube.com/theclayfoxes/videos, and that'll send you to all of the ones that that we have on there. There's a couple of covers that I've done, and then there's a couple of ones that I've wrote myself. So, and that particular song is called Now It's Over. If you hadn't guessed by the lyrics on the outro. It's actually about a breakup with a girlfriend. Not me though, but it's actually about breaking up with someone. So but yeah, so go and check that out and have a listen. But we haven't had any other emails, have we, this week, or have I missed one? Or
nope, that's it.
That's it. So okay, well, we must be just about done by now, mustn't we? Because we've gone over the hour.
I think our longest show yet. So
way over the hour, yeah. So yeah, so the only thing left from me is just to remember, we can explain it to you, but we can't understand it for you.
Okay. If you want to email us, you can use that mail at admin@podcast.co.uk, and we'll see you all soon, guys and girls.
See you soon. Bye now.
Bye.
And after you left, I was never the same.